Hello and welcome to Talking Scared. I'm your host, Neil McRobert, and this week we get newly weird. Our guest is Aaliyah Whiteley, novelist, short story writer, and poet who straddles every line there is between horror, science fiction, fantasy, absurdity, and the surreal. And she brings it all together into what she likes to call the strange. Her new collection of stories, From the Neck Up, is out now from Titan Books. It's a disturbing, disarming concoction, full of disembodied heads, fleshy scarecrows, arcane rituals, and dark agriculture. And that's about as good a description as I can give of it. Honestly, Aaliyah's fiction defies any attempt at easy categorisation. She does love a good bit of mushroom horror, though, I'll say that. We worked together in this conversation to decide on a category for her stories, and we kind of fail. Along the way, though, we take in ecology and evolving change, the history of British science fiction, the future of folk horror, and the legends of her native Devon. So, with that in mind, come with me to a rural corner of Britain. The land there is erupting with growth, and not all of it is healthy. Let's talk scared. Welcome to Talking Scared, Aaliyah. How are things?
Good. Thanks for asking me to come along. How are you?
I'm fine. As I've just told you, it's one of the about 18 times in the last year that I think I may have COVID. Every time I feel the slightest bit unwell, I'm convinced I've got COVID. This is the latest bout of pseudo COVID. Yeah, but I'm fine in the whole. It's been a long weekend here in the UK. Most of my listeners are American at the moment, so they won't understand the joy of a bank holiday weekend. But essentially, we've had a long weekend off work.
Oh, you've got to love a bank holiday. I've ended up watching one of the Sinbad films this afternoon, which is the key bank holiday experience, really, isn't it?
Absolute textbook. Any Harryhausen kind of stuff with stop motion things from the 70s, that
Perfect.
Is how to spend a bank holiday week. Yeah, exactly. That or kind of watching snooker with your gran. Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Dreary things, but they have their own kind of magic. It's actually been many, many weeks since I've had a fellow Brit on this show. We've been really kind of US heavy over the summer. My main concern is that I'm going to kind of immediately slip into incomprehensible gibberish and slang. So, but at least you're not Northern, which may save us.
No, I'm from Devon, so that's very Southern, isn't it?
It is about as Southern as you can get.
I might talk about cream peas or something like that at some point. That's about as bad as it gets.
Well, Devon's going to come up, actually, because I do want to talk about that, because I think Devon is a very ripe place for macabre fiction, so we'll come back to that.
Okay.
Actually, one of the things that struck me about your fiction is its sense of place and how strikingly the Britishness sits with some of the topics and the genre templates that you play with. But you know what? Let's not run before we can walk. We'll get to all of that.
Okay.
Let's introduce the book that you're kind of nominally here to discuss. From the Neck Up is your new collection of short fiction, which was published, well, will be published on the 14th of September, which at the time this goes out is yesterday.
Oh, that's good timing.
Yeah, that's by Titan Press. Now, it's the second of your books that I've read, following The Beauty.
Okay.
And quite honestly, it's one of the most discombobulating set of stories that I've read in quite a while. So very few stories sit easily in any single genre. They don't end where or when you expect them to, and there's no two are alike, although there is an underlying feeling that there is some collective purpose. But in the whole, it's kind of tied my head in knots.
Oh, good. I think that's good.
Yeah. No, it is good. It's very good. Yeah. It's always hard to summarize a collection, I know, but I'm going to ask you to kind of do your best and tell my listeners what you think they should know about From the Neck Up.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So From the Neck Up is a collection of what I kind of set out to collect maybe my favorite stories I'd written over the last 10 years. And that it became quite a difficult process to kind of narrow that down. And at first, much as you say, it doesn't really abide by any one genre, but I don't really write stories that fall even within sort of one story easily into a genre. So I abandoned the idea of having any sort of genre to it apart from that feeling of discomfort, maybe, that it doesn't really play by those sort of rules. And I went through them, and I found sort of themes of organic growth, themes of change. And I picked stories that kind of tied into that idea and put them all together. And from the neck up's the result.
Yeah, and it's quite the result. Organic growth, post-humanism, all that kind of stuff comes up again and again. To describe this from my perspective, kind of similar to what you just said, it's an unsettling, slippery blend of horror, science fiction, the surreal. But there's also some absurdist comedy in there. There's some kind of social, ecological commentary in the mix. To boil the concoction down a little, I've seen you referred to as a major voice in what people are calling the new weird. And that's a capitalized new weird. So I think that's a good place to start. How do you feel about that term? Do you think of yourself as part of that church? And if so, what should we understand the new weird to be?
That's one way of looking at it, the new weird. I think the phrase the new weird, I kind of associate that with like an earlier sort of generation of writers here, I guess. I like the term the weird with a capital W in the sense that I've heard people say if you could describe it, then that would ruin it. I think that's probably pretty good. It's like in all the spaces, in all the spaces that are kind of left over between sci-fi, horror, fantasy, bit of crime, and then literary as well. You know, if you stir them all together and something that pops out may well be weird. If I'm asked to talk about it myself, I usually just say they're strange. They're strange stories. I like strange better than weird, but I'm happy to be called, you know, a writer of the weird. I think that in itself has a good ring, and there's a number of great writers who've belonged to that category, so why not? Yeah, I'll take that.
Well, indeed. I mean, and some of those writers have been on this show. I mean, the two guests that I've read that you most kind of align with are Brian Evanson and Jeff Vandermeer, who have both also been described as part of the new weird or weird. I mean, Jeff, you know, Vandermeer wrote that great kind of anthology of the weird, didn't he? And I can't help but read in particular your collection From the Neck Up as a kind of transatlantic cousin of Brian Evanson's newest, The Glassy Burning Floor of Hell. And Brian was on the show a few weeks ago, because it feels like you've both got this similar obsession with, as you said, organic growth, and particularly the organic meeting the inorganic and the post-human and body horror. And all of those strands seem inevitably in both of your work to lead back or lead onward to kind of ecological nightmare, which is something that Jeff Vandermeer's work does as well, you know?
Absolutely, yeah.
We'll skate away from this phraseology, the new weird, and we can say, you know, the strange or whatever you want to call it. But do you think there's something about this kind of writing that lends itself at the moment to eco-horror? And those kinds of the topics?
I think from a personal point of view, absolutely, it has something to do with, you know, climate change and the environment and the way that we interact with the world and live within the world. Humanity, you know, whether that's separate from nature or part of nature is a big part of questions that concern me. And I would be really surprised if it wasn't concerning other writers out there and we're tackling the same thing in different ways. I think, you know, with Vandermeer's kind of Annihilation and whatever, that certainly rang a lot of bells for me in terms of things that I'm concerned about. So that's part of it for sure. Absolutely. I wouldn't say that's all of it. I think there's an awful lot of stuff about individualism, but that also ties very much into trying to define a role within the world. It's murky territory, isn't it?
It is.
How could you live in the world today and not be concerned about the climate and nature and what we're doing to it and what it does to us? So, yeah.
I just find it interesting that obviously that is the pressing kind of concern, the existential terror that underlies everyone's life if they've got a modicum of sense, you know, like if you're not Jeff Bezos or some oil magnate in Alberta, Canada, you know, they probably don't care that much. But the rest of us are having to live in this very, very impending, immediate nightmare. And But it's weird that mainstream fiction and mainstream storytelling doesn't seem to be taking it on. It seems to be left to the strange, as you put it, to kind of confront that terror, which I just find really weird, because you would think that every major author in the world would be writing an eco horror novel, but they're not. It's Jeff and Brian and yourself who are kind of coming at it from these weird angles, and as you said, the space between genres. I just wonder what that's about. I wonder whether you've got any thoughts on why it takes that off-kilter approach.
Yeah, it's I think the strange or the weird accommodates it very well, as it accommodates things that both terrify us and feel ephemeral in a way, like we can't really pin it down yet, but we know it's coming. That kind of horror is a very traditional sort of bedfellow of this, the weird, I think, and that's what it feels like to me, as if it does belong naturally in horror, as a series of events. So yeah, I don't know why we don't see more people tackling it in a more straightforward way, or maybe I'm just not looking in the right places than they are.
Well, if you aren't, I'm not either. Because I'm waiting for Stephen King to churn out an eco horror novel, and he's not. And I'm waiting for, you know, Joe Hill and all these big names. You know, if these are the kind of mouthpieces of terror and horror in the world that we have, it seems odd that they're all neglecting this fundamental existential crisis. You know, it's on the scale of something that Lovecraft would write. You know, it is true cosmic existential horror.
It's just cosmic, isn't it? Yes.
Yeah, but no one is taking it on apart from, as I say, these off-kilter approaches from the margins.
Yeah.
All right, let's take it a bit broader then. So you've mentioned organic growth, and I know that you have your own special relationship with fungi and the mushrooms and all that kind of stuff. But
yeah,
and you said these are books, these are stories kind of taken from over 10 years of writing.
Yeah.
Do you have any idea or insight into why these weird topics keep coming forth in your fiction? Was it a surprise to you when you kind of found the connective tissue between them?
Yeah, it was a surprise. It wasn't until quite recently I realised that I had written a lot about that kind of sort of overtaking organic growth and how that relates to humanity. The first time mushrooms kind of popped up on my radar, I was writing non-fiction articles for sort of 20 pounds a pop, basically. And I wrote one about, just picking any subject randomly, I wrote one about extinction events. There have been sort of 5 or 6 extinction level events that have affected the world beforehand. And I read randomly while researching them that after, I don't know if it's all of them, but certainly one of them in particular, fungi was the real winner. You know, the kind of, there then follows a period where fungi are incredibly prevalent and huge and doing amazing things because death is kind of what they spring from. So I think that really caught my imagination. I've always been obsessed with Day of the Triffids as well, absolutely. That's the first kind of sci-fi book I remember reading. Something about, after that I was taken to a botanical park. And there was an enormous kind of plant there. And I got it in my head somehow that it was a triffid. so I think, you know, it's weird. You can't really say where inspiration comes from. But I was surprised to see, for something that me that felt like it was in the background probably, to what I was trying to write about, suddenly it turned out that was really the thing that connected a lot of the stories.
Yeah, because agriculture and horticulture and botanical stuff is just, it comes up again and again in these stories.
It does.
But the fungi, obviously, because in The Beauty, which I actually read because someone on this show recommended it to me, one of the guests, I can't remember who, I tried to find out who it was to tell you.
Oh, that's really cool.
I think it may have Gemma Files, because fungi was having its time at that moment as well, because I don't know whether you've read Sylvie Moreno Garcia's Mexican Gothic.
I haven't read it yet. I hear it's mushroom related, so.
Oh, it's very, it's very mycological. it plays a big part. But I've always said there is something very creepy about mushrooms, because I found out late in life that there is this thing, you'll know a lot more than me, that they can all share a kind of central system under the ground. Is this right that they can always be one entity?
Yeah.
I can't articulate why. There is something just awful about that. So it just really creeps like this huge, this huge all-encompassing brain beneath my feet. I just think it's such an alien concept.
Yeah. And when I found out the largest organism, living organism on the planet is a fungi. That's amazing. There's one, the humongous fungus, right, in the US that's taking up, I think it's Oregon, it takes up.
Is that right?
The ground there.
We're all going to have to bow down to our fungi overlords at some point, aren't we?
Yes, for one welcome them.
Yeah. So you mentioned America there, and I mentioned in the intro that I like the Britishness of your fiction. Because one of the things I really enjoyed is this kind of like presence of mundane British life within these really fantastical scenarios.
Now,
maybe it's just me, of course, because maybe someone from, I don't know, Arkansas or New Hampshire would read the local colour in your stories and find them incredibly exotic, you know what I mean? but to me, reading on home ground, there is this grounding element to British social realism that's completely unmythical. And it seems almost more surreal to have these grand tapestries laid over them.
Yes.
Especially when it comes to things, you know, to like apocalyptic tales, of which there are many in this collection, because they always seem more at home in the kind of wide open North American epic landscape. And there's one story in this called Reflection, Refraction, Dispersion, in which it all revolves around big indoor arenas where this strange phenomena is happening. And you mention all these cool places like the Superdome and the Houston Astrodome, and then you also mentioned Cardiff Principality Stadium.
And I think that's the really, first time it happened.
It really made me laugh. It made me chuckle. But it did lead me to think more deeply that, like, in terms of the strange and this kind of fiction, as I've said, I compared you to Brian and stuff, do you feel there is a difference in setting these things in Britain?
I've talked to other writers about it, actually, and I can't remember who it was, but somebody said to me that Canadian postal apocalyptic fiction has these wide open spaces, you know, like this vast feeling of openness to it, and that in itself is where part of the fear comes from. You know, you're really completely on your own. But the British apocalypse, and again, I'm really influenced by Wyndham here, you know, the kind of sense of keep calm and carry on, we're going to find a way to get through this probably all together somehow. But then that brings its own particular horror, where you have to find a way to create a way to live with other people within that scenario. So I don't know which I'd prefer, actually, whether I'd prefer the wide open spaces of Canada or, you know, having to work out who's taking the minutes to the meeting of who gets the supply of the last supply of apples. You know,
that's what I mean, isn't it? It's like you, by writing about things in Britain, you're always kind of forced to keep it at a human level, because you can never really rely on the landscape to be something to get lost in. You're never going to be that far from the local kind of Tesco Express, or you know, or insert other gritty Mike Lee style social realism. So, yeah, is it? Does it change the way you write? Do you have to think about it in a different way? Do you have to think like, okay, how would we deal with this if we lived in a cul-de-sac, or how would, you know, we deal with this if there was like happens to the bus route? Does it force you into a kind of more a minor way of thinking as opposed to the epic register?
I think it's a fun comparison to play with. So it probably, like, the pathetic nature of some of the characters and what they're thinking really nicely undermines this huge event, and then you play with the two together, and that's really fun as a writer. So I think that's probably where it comes from. I think one of the stories in the book, Compel, is kind of about an alien invasion where something really weird is happening, but it's actually affecting the ability of the narrator's language to talk about what's happening. And so you end up with quite a British sort of feeling to it, simply because he's forever sort of reaching for smaller language, you know, to try and juggle what's happening. And I think maybe it's something to do with that. It's like the juxtaposition of the two is really, really interesting.
that story was the most frightening story in the collection for me. Because
really?
But particularly for me, yeah, I have this weird thing where I when I have kind of like anxious moments or stressful moments, I get very, very, very wound up by my inability to explain what is happening in my head. So I get quite anxious about my inability to say why I'm feeling anxious, and it's like becomes like a bit of a vicious cycle. So reading a story about somebody who is physically unable to articulate certain things,
yeah,
I found it very, very distressing. I thought it was a really creepy idea.
Yeah, me too. It's kind of that something to do with how we connect and communicate with each other, and something that really undermines that. But also takes away your ability to even think of it properly in your own head before you can even begin to explain it. I found that a very creepy thought.
It almost ironically articulated my own inarticulation when it comes to how I struggle with life sometimes. You nailed it. It happens a lot with me in short stories. It's quite weird how often I read a short story which seems to absolutely hit the bullseye on one of my various neuroses. It comes up a lot on this show where I'm talking to authors saying it's like you found the absolute target point of my anxiety and life's like a dart.
Is that good though? Does it feel good?
Not generally. No.
Does it feel good to be seen in that way, or no? It's just painful, really.
No, it's it's just unusual. The novels never do it. Novels never skewer me in that way. Mm. It's if ever I'm really frightened by a fiction, it will always be a short story. I think it's about the purity of the idea that you can really just twist the knife on one nerve ending.
Yeah.
In a novel, you've got to do so much more.
Yeah, sometimes short stories feel like trying to hit a bullseye. So if you've done that, then you've hit a bullseye, right? But novels, quite often you're kind of moving around the target, kind of working inwards. So I guess you get like a more diffuse effect to get to something that's hopefully very meaningful at the end. But if you, you know, that short and sweet kind of couple of pages that really just go straight for the jugular. Yeah, ow. Painful.
I mean, obviously you write in both disciplines. You write novels and you write short fiction. Yep. Do you feel more comfortable in one or the other?
I think the novella is actually my natural sort of place. Usually about 30 to 40,000 words would be where I would quite happily stop. That doesn't sit well with a huge amount of publishers. but I really like that kind of length. But to be fair, I do have some ideas that are absolutely short stories, and then they're encapsulated and done. And I rarely want to go back and revisit an idea. So I don't think I've ever sort of taken a short story and then drawn it out into a longer length. They don't seem to work like that for me. So yeah, but I don't think about it in advance. So
oh, really? You just sit down with an idea and see where it goes?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh right. Okay. That's interesting.
Yeah. I can get a sense sometimes if it's going to be a novel because it feels meatier and I know there's going to be a lot of stuff to get through. And usually that has something to do with the amount of characters quite early on. If like other characters are turning up and then I start to get flashes of where I want to go in the future and I start to think this is something longer. But between kind of short story, novelette, novella, I don't always know what I'm going to get.
The reason I find that so interesting is that I make notes. I don't write questions there. I just write down notes about things to kind of touch on when we talk.
Sure.
And I've noticed that I've made lots of notes for you about the style and the ambiguity and the frankly the oddness of your short fiction compared to other more conservative writers. And what you just said there kind of throws that in a whole new light. The fact that you don't know the length of the tale before you start writing it, that really shakes up what I thought, because, well, there's a few things. So first of all, there's so much ambiguity in these tales.
Yeah.
So much ambiguity. And it's not always, or it's actually quite rarely in terms of what is happening. That's often quite clear. More often, it's ambiguity in terms of why it's happening and what the consequences will be.
Okay.
So I suppose, and obviously that's informed now by the fact that you say you don't necessarily know where it's going to go when you start. But do you ever worry about clarity, or that you need to give your readers more, or at least more stable ground to stand on?
No, I really don't. No, I think... Sometimes I go back through and take things out. In fact, I do the opposite.
Right. So you like keeping us on our...
I really like... I really like it if people bring to it their own personality and it is informed by that. I like the spaces between stories, I think, is what I'm really interested in.
Because on your website, it mentions that you like stories where you have no idea what's going to happen next.
Yeah, right? Love it.
And
yeah.
That, having read your short fiction now, I can completely see that, because these stories are utterly anarchic in where they go and what happens next. And there's none of the usual kind of tram lines that, you know, in 90% of stories, there are tram lines that you can see kind of where this is going.
Yeah.
Often, you know, even if they pull out like a late act twist.
Yeah.
Generally, you can see the shape of the narrative.
Yeah.
You just cannot at all in your fiction. And is that how you feel when you're writing them? Do you have no idea where it's going?
I sometimes have like an idea. I have like flashes of moments that I want to work towards, but sometimes I throw them away. So depending along the way, if I get there and then think, actually, I don't want to do that, I won't do it. It's a really sort of free process. And I really enjoy that. I enjoy, you know, not, I think with, I love a lot of genre fiction. And I really enjoy, sometimes I'm really in the mood for a book that's really well signposted. And you know, as you say, you know what you're going to get. But on the other hand, sometimes I find that a bit too much of a comfort blanket. And then I feel like, oh, I know, pretty much certain I know exactly where this is going. And you can enjoy the ride. But when I'm writing myself, I don't want to see exactly where the rails are going, and I don't want the reader to know at the same time. And I've never been able to work out if that's just selfish on my part because that's what I enjoy, or if it's something that, you know, readers do enjoy.
It's an interesting one. I think it depends from story to story, because I've said before to kind of short fiction writers on this show that I'm not really the ideal short fiction reader because often short fiction is much more experimental. It's much more willing to play with rules than the novel, which is a much more conservative, on the whole, a conservative genre. And I'm one of these people that I, with a short story, I quite often crave a very kind of traditional beginning, middle and end. And I know what that was trying to tell me. And obviously that is not in any way the trend for short fiction in the last 30 years, you know, at all. But what I found is that it's not ambiguity that I don't like, it's pointlessness. And I find there's lots and lots of stories that just feel utterly pointless. Like I nothing changed in that character's life. There was no development, nothing going away. It's just a vignette. I can't be dealing with that. That's not what your stories do. Your stories go a long way. A lot happens. There's a lot of point to them. It's just quite often hard to work out what it is you're really trying to make me think, but it sounds like you're not trying to make me think, and it sounds like you're trying to get me to bring what I want to the party.
I think so. I think if there was like something that I was deliberately bringing, it would probably be change happens, you know, and as you say, a lot happens. I really move quickly through plot, and there's always definitely plot going on.
There's always a lot of action and movement, quite often physical movement, which I like in a short story. There's nothing worse than someone sitting there contemplating the navel for 8 pages and getting over. I like that there is actual like physical journeys and transitions and change in your stories.
Yeah, a lot of physical journeys, actually. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think thinking about it. But what that means, I don't know. I don't want to say, you know, in a really tired way, that's just like a metaphor for life, isn't it? You know? We're all changing and we're all on a journey, blah, 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 blah. But it's there's something going on there about the nature of not being able to comprehend the meaning of what you're going through at the time that you're going through it. And maybe it's the act of trying to get that mirrored in the reader, who then has to think about it later and think, what does that mean to me? What did I experience through that? Yeah, maybe.
So... To finish up this little analysis of how you craft and give us these stories, like I said, the fact that you said you don't necessarily know where they're going has changed things for me. Because the thing that I found the most interesting and the most befuddling, I suppose, as well, is how you decide when to end a story.
Yeah.
Because there's two examples that come to mind in here. Like, I mean, this happens in quite a few, but the two that really struck me are The one I mentioned earlier about the stadiums, Reflection, Refraction, Dispersion, and a really creepy folk horror tale called Star in the Spire. And both of them seem to work. Like you sketch this utterly surreal scenario and you plunge the reader into it without any kind of comfort or kind of safety rings. And then things happen. And in A Star in the Spire, really grisly things happen.
Yeah.
And then the story seemed to end at almost random moments. And What I couldn't work out is how you decided that's where it ends. How did you make that call? Because there's nothing in the story that kind of alerts me as a reader to think, oh, that is a natural stopping point.
I think in both, I wouldn't say this is true for everything, but in both of those examples, I felt like I'd reached the cusp of a moment where if I went on, it would ruin it somehow, or it would solidify it in some way.
Right.
As an experience. But also, I'd reached the point where from my understanding of the main character, a point of understanding for them had been reached.
Okay.
But obviously, it doesn't have to be the same point of understanding for the reader at all, so it doesn't work that way, does it? But it felt like a natural stopping point and the moment before it would necessarily become something more solid.
Yes, that makes perfect sense, because that's how I felt, that like if we went another page here I may begin to understand this situation. And there's a kind of frustration and also a satisfaction in being denied that. You know, particularly in A Star in the Spire, which is, as I say, it's a grisly tale about scarecrows that contain dark things and these vines that have a kind of sinister purpose. Yeah, it felt like another few minutes with that character and all would become clear.
I do wonder sometimes if I read my own stuff for the first time, if it would really annoy the heck out of me, actually, in a kind of, what comes next? But genuinely, I don't want to solidify it in my own mind. So maybe that's a better way to describe it.
So you don't know what happens next either?
No.
What a kind of high wire way to write stories, that sounds like.
I have ideas, but I would never kind of write it down or say it to another person to make it solid. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I can see why you shy away from novels then, because obviously a novel kind of demands resolution and at least some kind of clarity, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, I have written novels and I enjoy that, but there are always moments when writing a novel when I feel, well, I just have to actually knuckle down and do this. And then it's long, hard work of months of doing something that I don't really enjoy in order to get to the bits that I really do enjoy.
I'm guessing the stories are all play.
Yeah, pretty much.
And a novella, I suppose. A novella, you can stretch out that suspension of clarity for as long as possible and really kind of twist the knife into the reader. Yeah. Novellas are getting more and more popular. It feels like there's been a turning point in the last year, maybe, where I'm now seeing lots of novellas getting decent coverage and decent releases and getting a bit more respect, I think.
That's really good.
That bodes well, because one of my favourite kind of books to read is a collection of novellas. You know, you'll get like Stephen King does it and it's Joe Hill does it, where you get kind of four stories of a decent chunky length, but you can read them in one sitting.
Actually, I've been reading a collection of Ursula Le Guin's novellas and they all sit really well together, you know, and it's a big chunky book. It's a satisfying experience. Mm-hmm. Yeah, very enjoyable.
I'm glad you mentioned other authors, because I meant to ask you, I've already alluded to the fact that, you know, you write in a kind of very British way as opposed to the American tradition. And I compared you to kind of Brian Evanson and Jeff Vandermeer, who were both, you know, in that American tradition. And it feels like to me their lineage is quite clear, that the sci-fi horror lineage, I think, in American letters is much more straightforward than it is in the British tradition. Because the British tradition has always been a kind of weird. It's always been weird with a small W. It's always been kind of odd, isn't it? Like, you've mentioned Wyndham, and there's people like John Christopher and Death of Grass, which is one of my favourite books. And
that's such a great book.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And Ballard and going on into people like Gaiman and China Miéville and people like that. Like,
yeah, absolutely.
It's not really tradition. It's not an obvious...
It's not like a through line, is there?
No, it's lots of people writing in the... It's still white guys, but it's lots of people writing in the margins.
Yeah.
And I kind of wanted to ask, I suppose, like, who are your literary inspirations?
I think Angela Carter, probably has a lot to do with it, particularly like the Bloody Chamber. So fairy tales on that side, I certainly was very drawn to fairy tales. And then when I came across her imaginings of fairy tales and the literary quality of that, but this kind of hot, surreal language that goes with that, that's very, very much an influence. And Doris Lessing.
Yes.
So
I feel quite bad now that I basically made a list of the British science fiction tradition, just mentioned men. that wasn't intentional at all, because of course Lessing, yeah.
Alan Moore and Neil Gaiman, as you say, with the sort of graphic novels, that's a big influence on me. And I think a lot of my stuff is quite vivid because I read so many graphic novels when I was younger. Sandman and Watchmen, you know, those kind of things really, really influenced me, yeah. I think. Yeah, Swamp Thing.
I keep firing tweets out into the ether trying to get Neil Gaiman on this show, and one day he will crack and I'll have him. I saw an interview with you, or rather an excerpt from an interview, that really fascinated me. And you've mentioned Lessing and you've mentioned Angela Carter and people that I can kind of obviously see in the background of your fiction. Mm. But I saw an interview where you said that your introduction to weird fiction began with Daphne du Maurier's Rebecca.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And it kind of really intrigued me because obviously my background's in Gothic. Mm. And I understand Rebecca as a Gothic novel. Mm. And aside from the gender politics, a relatively, in my eyes, conservative Gothic fiction. Mm. And I'm just interested in how it ties into your notion of the weird and who you are as a writer. Because I cannot see any connective tissue between you and du Maurier from my level. You know what I mean? I'm intrigued.
That's because of the way it does something. It did something to me. I think it was the first book I picked up. And before that, I'd been given sort of children's books. And children's books are really usually very well signposted into what you're getting and why you're getting it. And then I think a family member gave me a copy of Rebecca that she'd bought in a car boot sale. It didn't have a dust jacket anymore. So there's no blurb. There's no nothing. It was just a red book with a gold R in the corner. So I think I was about 13. I just started reading it. Thought, oh, this is a romance. That's great. I knew nothing about it. And then it just started to take a really sinister turn. And this house, Manderley, appeared. And I really felt there were concepts that I hadn't come across before and I didn't know where we were going or where it was going to lead. And I wouldn't have been surprised if, I don't want to ruin Rebecca for anybody, if there are still people out there who haven't read it or whatever, but I really thought he was going to be a murderer, but it turned out he was a murderer, but in a different way. You know, whether this was going to be him chasing her down corridors with an axe or what was going to happen. And my imagination overtook events and completely subsumed into Manderley. And I think, you know, haunted houses and strange old houses still play a large part of, take up a lot of room in my brain. So I think it's to do with the experience I had with it.
Okay.
Definitely. And then I discovered Jamaica Inn on top of mm-hmm. that. And again, it was doing a similar sort of dark thing. And I just felt there was potential in there for something really terrible to happen. And although when you look back on it, it never really does, right? I mean, in the same way, terrible things do happen, but I felt there was room for real terror. I found real terror.
So it's kind of like that safety. It's about feeling unsafe with fiction then. Is that the thing that makes...
Exactly.
Because that's how your stories feel, if I think about it. Like, obviously, as I say, there's no tram line, so it could go anywhere. So who knows what...
Yeah.
The next page may bring the most unbridled horror imaginable because there's clearly no rules in place here.
Yeah, it's to do with that.
Okay, I get it now. I get the connective tissue between your weird stories and du Maurier. I would never have got there on my own, but I get it.
I like that, though. I like the fact you can't kind of find an instant.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, no, my ears really picked up when I heard the interview. I was like, oh, I've got to ask about that. So, I mean, that brings us to Devon then, doesn't it? I said we'd mention Devon.
Yeah.
So obviously the land of Mandalay and Jamaica Inn and Baskerville Hall for, yep. you know, the purists. Devon is a weird place.
Yeah.
It's such a ripe location for the darker end of art.
It is, yeah.
Do you think your childhood there has in any way shaped your imagination?
Totally. Absolutely. I think we'd, you know, go to Exmoor the weekends and walk around. Do you know the book Lorna Doone? Story of a woman who shot you can go to the church there where she was, I mean, it's a fiction, but where she was shot through the window on her wedding day or whatever. That's a gloomy little church in the middle of Exmoor. Mm-hmm. That all had a big influence. And at the same time, I was on the more urban side of it. I was working in a seaside town. I mean, as soon as you became a teenager, you went out to work in one of the local businesses because it's a holiday town. Mm-hmm. So I was chambermaiding and sort of letting myself into people's rooms and tidying up after them. And that, I find that incredibly sort of creepy and strange to be amongst the possessions of these people I don't know. And them, you know, out having their holiday and the stories of their lives around that experience. It's, yeah, a very strange time. Yeah, it was a weird upbringing.
I went to Devon this summer on my very cliched COVID kind of run for the hills.
Sure. You know,
let's go on holiday quickly. We were going to go somewhere. Let's go and infect the people in the south as everyone in the north did. I'd never been to Devon as an adult. I'd been when I was like six or something. Mm. And I was kind of taken aback by just how eerie it is as a landscape.
Yeah.
So we drove through Dartmoor and we saw the prison and then we went all the way to Lynmouth.
Oh, amazing.
There's an amazing story that I read about where like there was a flood in 1952 or something. And they literally, the town got together and pushed a lifeboat over a mountain to get to the other side of the peninsula so they could rescue a boat. Like they literally carried a boat over a mountain. And it's just a part of the country that is like machine tooled for stories.
Mm. It's an incredible place. It
is. Everywhere you look, it just feels like there is story.
In fact, you know, Lynmouth's at the bottom of the cliff and Linton is the town at the top of the cliff and the Valley of the Rocks is next to Linton. That's where the beauty's set.
Right. Of course, it's called the Valley of the Rocks. Of course, yeah. How have I not made that connection?
Yeah, and you walk from Lynmouth up through Watersmeet. That's just one of my favourite places on earth. Just absolutely beautiful and creepy as heck at the same time. Just
yeah. Dear North America, you're all listening. Go to Devon. I would say this, like, if you're listening to this from the US or Canada, the places we're talking about are what you think Britain is. Like, you know, like when you see these TV programs, that's what they're showing you. Yeah, Devon is like paradise. It's like a haunted paradise.
And the thing as well with kind of smuggling and wrecking, so this, you know, it's got like, I think it's the highest cliffs in England are in Devon. And this story of kind of people who would go out onto the cliffs with lanterns during fog and lure boats onto the rocks to wreck them deliberately and then kill everybody who tried to swim ashore and take the goods. And there's a darkness there. Also, Ilfracombe, which is my hometown, has Chambercombe Manor, in which, you know, a walled up skeleton was discovered and a ghost is said to lurk there. And it's dark, dark place.
Yeah, yeah.
I love it.
And then there's the Hairy Hands of Dartmoor.
Oh, I love the Hairy Hands. Yeah.
We'll say that for a later conversation. But yeah, that is, yeah.
By now, you've heard me talk about my partnership with Novelic. It's a brand new book app that's designed to help you find your next favourite read without any of the nasty stuff that comes with certain other book aggregators. There are no reviews, no star ratings, or any of the guff that awful people can use to game the system. Instead, it's just pure recommendations based on your tastes, your friends, and your reading history. It's especially good for genre fans with curated lists in all kinds of categories, compiled from real readers, not algorithms. And there is, of course, a Talking Scared reading list. Just click the banner. And don't forget the book clubs. Join one or create your own and chat away. It's like WhatsApp for book nerds. Obviously, Talking Scared has a book club already on there, exclusive to Patreon listeners, so sign up and come join the conversation. Bring your own biscuits. You can download Novelic for free on Apple or Android. It's another way for us to talk about horror.
What struck me about these stories, to go back to your fiction for a while, I mentioned that story before, Star in the Spire.
Yeah.
It really felt like a kind of folk horror tale.
Yeah.
Where this man is walking around in some unspecified, ambiguous kind of wasteland and finding these scarecrows and strange things happening. And then there's another story called Corwick Grows.
Yeah.
In which somebody's basically taken and made into a kind of almost like, as I read it, like a kind of source of fuel for a growing community and stuff like that. And I'm trying not to be too prescriptive for spoilers.
Yeah.
But it felt like they were kind of folk horror stories. And that obviously feels like something that would possibly grow out of a childhood in Devon, in which you're living very close to like the seasons and to nature and to the natural world.
Sure.
Do you see that in your own work, that folk horror tradition?
Yes. Sometimes, particularly with Star in the Spire, I think I wrote that initially for an anthology about weird or speculative approaches to climate change. And I felt quite strongly that I was harking back to Witchfinder General, sort of a cinematic, the Wicker Man, a cinematic kind of tradition of strangeness, where the landscape is so unfriendly and beautiful on the screen.
I'm so glad you've said that, because we're actually of the same mind about one thing. So I was trying to work out whether I was making up this thing and imposing it on your work, but it sounds like I'm not. So there's those stories we've talked about, which are recognisably, in my eyes, folk horror. But there are others in this collection, and the opening novella, Brushwork, is a good example, right? And these stories present these kind of ecological nightmares, to me, as a kind of updated folk tale.
Yeah.
Because that story, for example, is about this woman working in some kind of sealed environment to keep plant life going in the aftermath of, presumably, a climate disaster.
Yeah.
And there's kind of ritual involved and stuff. And it feels like these eco-horrors have a focus on climates and seasons and the balance of the natural and the imbalance of the natural.
Yeah.
And it feels like those things are actually going full circle and returning us to exactly the same ground that folk horror used to cover. Kind of like a neo-folk tradition almost.
Oh, wow. That's, yeah. I haven't thought about it in those terms, but I can see where you get that from. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it's like you're writing folk horror for the future.
Oh, I like that. I do love folk horror, so if that's what I'm doing, I'm really pleased with that. The Brushwork feels more traditionally kind of sci-fi to me, but certainly there's that obsession with the organic and the natural world, and also I would say generational change as well is a big part of that story. So there is this quality of what we're passing on from one generation to another. So if that's also the tradition of folk horror, then I'm really happy with that. Yeah.
Yeah, that very much, but also, as I say, this sense of ritual to me, which ties into the organic and the inorganic. Honestly, the dance we do, to not give away spoilers, but... But yeah, I couldn't help but, as you were saying, like the Wicker Man and Witchfinder General, it felt like that had been smashed together into something like Soylent Green or what's the film where they're in space and it's
Silent Running.
Looking after Silent Running. It felt like Silent Running meets the Wicker Man.
Parts of Silent Running were very much in my head, yeah, writing it. You know, that lone figure who's kind of within that, completely within their own routine. And the only concern is plant life and can we keep it alive and what can we do with that, and I loved that character. I felt that was really inspirational.
Yeah, inspirational is the word, actually. Amongst all the darkness and the horror, there is a kind of inspirational thing. There's quite a lot of stuff in this collection about women, particularly older women, having a kind of moment of becoming and a moment of kind of self-realization.
Yeah,
that's very much the case in Brushwork.
Yeah,
and it's also weirdly the case in the title story, you know, From the Neck Up, which is all about someone coming into their own again through horticulture.
Yeah, yeah, that's true, yeah. Although I think that's a little more sort of comedic in tone. And again, certainly generational concerns within that. Yeah, so about the change within a person and through generations in order to get to a moment of understanding. I would say that's probably where those stories go in particular.
You are right. It is comedic from the neck up. It's probably the most comedic of the stories.
Yeah.
And you've just made me realize something which I hadn't considered, that we've talked about all these kind of grand narratives, you know, ecology and folk tradition and apocalypse and all that. But you picked what I suppose you could argue is the most minor, smallest story as the title story.
Yeah.
Why was that? What prompts you to make that one the title story?
I don't know. I really don't know. All I did to pick the title was read back through all the stories in the turn, thinking this is the order I want them to be in. That it's not exactly the order that I ended up with, because Star in the Spire was quite a late addition, swapped in for something else that with the editor we kind of decided in the end didn't quite gel so well. But Star in the Spire fitted in there very nicely. And I'd only just written that for something else, so I had to get the permission from the anthologist to include it, which they very kindly did. I went back through it and just looked for the slightly playful title. I wanted a playful element to the title, and also nothing that kind of suggested too much one genre or another. And that's the one I landed upon.
Because it's probably the most unrepresentative story in the collection. I thought there might be some kind of like real stance behind picking that one as the title story, just because it is so at odds with most of the other stories in the collection.
Yeah, no, not at all. I think looking at some of the other titles, if I'd picked them, you know, like Corwick Grows, and that's already giving it a flavour to the collection that I kind of wanted to avoid. You know, that's it really. Yeah.
Okay, well, here's a question to finish up with then. What's your favourite story in the collection?
I'm going to have a quick look at the title page now, see if I can... Today? Let's have a look. If I was going to read one back over, which I never do, but if I was going to read one over again, I would probably read Loves of the Long Dead. Yeah, Loves of the Long Dead today.
Let me get this right. That's the one about the... Is it xenophages? What are they called?
Xenophyophores. Xenophyophores. Yeah. I'm not quite sure how you say it. Yes, the deep in the Marianas Trench, the deep anemones.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That sent me to Google to check they were real. like gigantic single cell organisms that again, we need to be aware of what they're doing. We need to keep an eye on these things. I'm not convinced they're not sinister things. Right. Yeah. Okay. Why is that one your favourite then?
Just today, that would be the one that I would look at again. I think maybe I just feel quite warmly towards that one, because I set up a project where I was writing short stories, kind of one a month, for a Patreon, just to see if I could do it over the course of a year and be happy with the results. And a few people supported me, which was brilliant. And that was my favourite of the ones I wrote over that period. But then, of course, those stories have been published on the Patreon site, so they don't get published anywhere else. And I was really pleased to have the chance to include it in the collection. And I kind of like the juxtaposition of my princess and my scientist through different eras. And it's perhaps the story that travels the farthest distance, kind of geographically and historically. Yeah.
It starts in ancient Egypt and then goes all the way to...
some year in the future. I can't remember what year in the future. Far in the future. Yeah.
My favourite story... Just to tell you, is also in principle the most horrifying, which will surprise no one. But it's also the one which has got the most, for me, perfectly judged balance of kind of secrets and revelations and kind of a sense of closure and ambiguity. And it's To the Farm.
Okay, yeah.
Just to give people an insight, it's kind of a nightmarish tale about unwanted children who are sent like pets to the apocryphal farm that may or may not exist, but it's more than that. And I'm only going to do this with one story, because it's otherwise it gets monotonous. But I'd like to ask you where you got the idea for that story, because it's such a dark tale.
I think there's obviously a lot of things that are kind of like it beforehand, but they never quite go all the way into horrible territory that one does. So you get like AI and things like that.
AI,
or
Never Let Me Go as well. It made me think quite a lot of Never Let Me Go.
Yes, you kind of get these children who are created in a way to fulfill an adult need, and that's a horrible concept to even begin with. And then I think about the time I was writing it, you know, my dog was ill and then sadly had to be put down. And I think that was kind of in the back of my mind. You know how they used to say, you know, he's gone to the farm, to children, you'd say.
Yeah.
The dog's died, but you'd never say that. You'd say, oh, he's gone to a farm. He's gone to a happy place. I find that a really emotional story, actually.
I think that's why I liked it. It's the one that hit the hardest to the heart. It's got a beautiful ending. Yeah, that was far and away my favourite. That and...
Oh, thank you.
You got to forgive me, I forgot the name of it. The one where the lady is kind of living her life and also her fictional life, and you're never quite sure where the two meet.
The Tears of the Building Surveyor, another story.
Yeah. That's another beautiful story.
Thank you.
Another one that felt quite at odds with the collection, but it was lovely. Yeah, they're my favourites. No, it's a dizzying piece of work. It goes in all kinds of directions. No one will get bored with this collection. It's one of those chocolate box. Here's a metaphor for you for this collection. You know, if you go to certain vodka bars in the UK and you can order a rack of different flavoured vodkas, and one of them could be chilli and it will burn the back of your throat, and one could be salt caramel, which tastes delightful, and you don't know what you're getting. And that's what this collection feels like when you start a story. You literally do not know what you're getting next.
That is perfect. I love that. Or the idea of, like, as you say, a box of chocolates, but you've lost the card and one of them might be frog-flavoured. You know, you just don't know.
Exactly that, yeah. Yeah, all those jelly beans where one's horrendous, yeah, and it will really horrify you.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Exactly so, that.
Something in there is gonna sting. Yeah, no, I like that. Thank you for that.
So finish off for us with the way we always do. If you could recommend a book for my listeners to read, what would it be and why?
Well, we've already talked about it briefly. I went through all sorts of ideas for this. But in the end, I think it's going to be Doris Lessing's The Memoirs of a Survivor, which to me is a hugely influential and inspirational book about generational horror and the way that we create the horrors that wait for us up ahead. So it's kind of about a woman who is living through an apocalypse. It's not post-apocalyptic. It's happening at the time in a very sort of low key. It really resonates right now in the sense that, there's not so much stuff in the shops, or how come the bins aren't empty today? And it's a breakdown that's happening all around. And at the same time, she's dealing with a daughter-like figure who is finding ways to be happier that horrify her. So there's a real generational struggle that goes to some really dark places, and I absolutely love it. So it was either that or Angela Carter's The Bloody Chamber, but in the end I came down on the side of the Doris Lessing.
Well, Angela Carter's had her recommendations already, so thank you for doing the other one. That spreads the wealth a little bit. Yeah, so I've never read Lessing. I've never read a single word by Doris Lessing, so I really need to correct that.
Yeah, read that one. Read The Memoirs of the Survivor. Yeah, and read The Fifth Child as well.
Yeah, The Fifth Child, Golden Notebook. Honestly, it's awful. There's always more books.
It's endless, isn't it? The endless books. But that's good. We wouldn't have it any other way. It's good.
No. And to finish off, as ever, the perennial question. Aaliyah, what truly scares you?
I'm a real scaredy cat, generally. I think people really scare me. Yeah, most people really scare me. But I'm also quite scared of being alone. So generally, everything sort of scares me.
That's quite the predicament.
It is. It's an unpleasant kind of situation, isn't it? But it is really good for a writer of horror or things that are meant to scare people, because I have lots of inspiration and grist for the mill. So, that kind of works out.
A blend of misanthropy and isolation.
And hope. So I guess I'm a bit of a Pandora's box, because also lurking in the corner, there's the hope that everything is going to turn out amazingly. I do nurture that quietly.
Well, that's a nice way to finish the conversation. It's rare we get such an upbeat finish, so let's leave it there before I ruin it. Yeah, as I've said, this is one of the most bewildering, beguiling, purely oddest collections I've read all year, and I think everyone will find something in it that will speak to them. So thank you for writing it, and Aaliyah Whiteley, thank you for talking scared.
Thank you very much. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Do you think I mentioned the climate crisis too much on this show? I sometimes worry about becoming a bit one-note. Obviously, talking to authors week after week, it's hard not to cross some of the same lines. And I know I have my own obsessions. The media, internet and how it's ruined the world, dreams and night terrors, the furious orange himself, Donald Trump. Those topics come up repeatedly. I do know that. The climate crisis, though, that just seems unavoidable in contemporary horror and speculative fiction. It's everywhere. It looms omnipresent and almost too vast to truly comprehend. Like I said, it's cosmic, a Lovecraftian threat from the void. Well, actually, maybe not the void, maybe more like an Amazon warehouse, but you catch my drift. If I do mention it too much, then sorry, but how can I not? Someone has to. I mean, like Aaliyah and I said, it's weird that the climate crisis, and I'm done with the phrase climate change, it just sounds too benign. The climate crisis has become the responsibility of the literary margins. You know, odd, offbeat writers like Aaliyah and Brian Evanson and Jeff Vandermeer, those who tread in the weird and the bizarre, they're the ones who are really carrying the torch and screaming that we're all going to die. Maybe it's because reality is just too frightening or too large and layered to address head-on. Maybe the only way into such a calamity is through a tilted window or through an odd little mouse hole in the literary skirting boards. That's how I would definitely describe Aaliyah's fiction. A story through a tilted window, all odd angles and weird refractions of light. As you heard me say at length, they have this weird way of going where you don't expect and finishing when you aren't ready, and leaving you scratching your head and sometimes feeling a bit sick to your stomach. And much like Brian Evanson, they leave you feeling like somehow Aaliyah has built an entire world and then destroyed it all in about 8 pages. These stories won't be for everyone, not by any means, but everyone will really love at least one of them, if that makes sense. So yeah, check out From the Neck Up if you're interested in a very alternative way of structuring and executing a story, as well as some fantastically funny moments of grim absurdity, which, at the end of the day, may be the only way we can really ever react to the climate disaster. Okay, that's the mini rant over. Until another day, or next week actually, when my guest and I get very incensed about a totally different topic. But for now, let's play nice. How are you all? Good? I am. By the time you hear this, I'll be at the Isle of Wight Music Festival, probably in the rain, drinking cider, with my best friends who I haven't seen in 2 years. Life is as good as it can possibly be in the twilight of a global pandemic, and I hope that wherever you are, you're finding your own moments of joy. Once travel does become feasible again, I fully intend to make 2022 the year in which Neil meets his audience. Now, sorry actually, I've made that sound like I plan to come around your house and knock on the windows. I don't. Although potentially that could be a new tier on the Patreon. What I mean is cons. I'm already eyeing up Scares That Care in April and the Stoker Con later in the year. Providing we're able to fly from the UK into the US from my little plague island, I do plan on being there. I have no idea what that kind of thing involves, but it sounds fun. Also, a bit closer to home, this November, I'll be at the UK Ghost Story Festival in Derby. I'll be recording some live episodes there and generally hanging about looking lost in between. So if you fancy a weekend of ghost stories and beer, come down and look for the most dishevelled bloke at the bar. I'll even buy you a drink. Nothing else to report this week, except to say a huge thanks to Pam Weiss and Stephanie Lorindo da Silva, the most recent members of the Talking Scared Patreon. Thanks, guys. It's hugely appreciated. I hope you all liked the recent extra episode with Grady and Chuck and Ron Malfi. And I've just uploaded an essay about zombies that I wrote about a decade ago. Total self-indulgence, that, I know, but after the Daniel Krause episode, I thought it might be a tiny bit interesting. If anyone wants to join Talking Scared Patreon, well, please do. It keeps me in podcasting funds, it allows me more time to focus on this show, and, well, it gives you extra content. A lot of extra content, as it's turned out. Including my now-planned mini-series on the full history of Gothic and horror that'll be coming out in time for Halloween. I'm doing that with a very celebrated academic, so yeah. Chance to learn a bit, I suppose. Me as well as you. The link for Patreon is in the show notes, or you can go directly to patreon.com/talkingscaredpod. Oh, and if you do, do download Novelic and come join the Patreon-exclusive Talking Scared book club. There's a good few of us there, currently giving our opinions on Stephen Graham Jones's My Heart is a Chainsaw, and everyone's lovely. Otherwise, say hi on Twitter at TalkScaredPod. Find me on Instagram for book covers and dog photos, or email me directly at talkingscaredpod@gmail.com. And lastly, breathe. If you've liked the show, then do subscribe and leave a review. Reviews are the lifeblood. Goth Christmas is coming, and I'm desperate to get this show promoted on those Halloween lists that go around of spooky stuff. iTunes reviews will help with that, definitely. I know, I'm a demanding host, but I hope you're still liking what I'm making for you. If not, actually, let me know. I can take criticism, and it can only make the show better. You'll love next week, though. It's a chat with Tina Baker about her psychological horror show Call Me Mummy. Tina's the most open and honest guest an interviewer could possibly dream of, and by God, do we talk about some stuff. But until then, keep your head on your shoulders. Avoid scarecrows, cultivate a garden, and eat less meat. Read good books, and remember, it's good to be scared.